On this week's Bet the Process podcast, it's a very special one because sadly, there's no Rufus, but we have the Whale Capper joining me and we have Jordan Majewski talking some X's and O's of the Sweet 16. We go through every single game with some angles from X's and O's and some betting angles, et cetera, et cetera. So with that, let's start the process.
Bet the process. Bet the process. Welcome to the podcast. Bet the process. It's not the typical cookie cutter nonsense. If you came just for picks, you're in the wrong place. Find a tout with the narrative to make a strong case. Instead of blindly assuming a team must be tanking, we're looking for the edge in Massey Peabody rankings. Crunching all the numbers in a simulated system that break down the data, analytically driven. Media coverage of sports gambling is pathetic.
Welcome to a very special episode of the Bet the Process podcast. I think I always say that, but this one's actually really special because Rufus isn't here, which is delightful. It's not delightful. It's sad that Rufus isn't here. But we have Whale Capper, Drew Dinsick.
You got it.
Dinsick. There, nailed it. It's one of those names that you've seen spelled, but I've never tried to say it.
Say it out loud. Said it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an honor to have you. This is probably the first time we've ever had a guest co-host, although I guess we've had a guest co-host when I haven't been here, and that's been another Peabody, Tom Peabody. But thanks for joining. Tell our listeners, who I'm sure most of them know who you are.
Yeah, sure. So first of all, thank you for the invite. It's an honor and a privilege. I am one of the original seven of the Bet the Process audience. So excited to be on co-hosting. And yeah, I mean, if you haven't seen my content floating around, I threw my hat into the ring as a media personality covering sports betting, trying to do it from the perspective of someone who is actually, you know, had skin in the game, but I'm also not anywhere close to the same level of kind of professional player as your normal co-host Rufus. However,
not many are
exactly. And I aspire to get there. The ultimate goal was, hey, let's start creating content. Let's try to make it, try to bridge entertainment and kind of advantage play if that's even possible. And in doing so, build out a network, learn more tricks, learn how to be a better player. And I think ultimately, if that was the goal when we got started doing the deep dive, that's kind of where I feel like I've gotten to now. And I, you know, hopefully by the end of my journey, I'm able to just kind of walk away from the media side of it and be sort of the end boss, at least in NFL and maybe tennis, probably never NBA, but I dare to dream. that's kind of the way things have gone for me. And, in the meantime, if you can be charismatic and if you don't have skeletons in your closet, then you end up being attractive to, a property like NBC who decides they need betting expertise to go along with their kind of stranglehold on the fantasy side of things. And so ended up getting a gig doing daily content for them, and everybody's happy over there, going on 3 years now. So this is kind of an accident because, I'm undergrad trained engineer, graduate school through master's on earthquake engineering and seismology. And it just happens that those skill sets cross over pretty well with thinking probabilistically about sports betting. And so the rest is history.
Okay. So you mentioned advantage players, and there was a recent tweet. I don't know if you saw this. Matt Perrault was talking about, I forget what it was, but obviously there's been a lot of backlash to mainstream media promoting sports betting, and Paralabob and some other people have been talking about, like the sort of how much these ads are in your face and this being sort of like a bad thing. Do you think advantage players are in a position to make the claim that Paralabob is, or do you think this like pushback? And by the way, that if you haven't seen the tweets from Matt Peralta and then the responses to him, they're kind of they're slaying a little bit, which is kind of funny because Matt is a polarizing figure in the sports betting community. But I invite you guys to go on Twitter and read that because it's good stuff. But I mean, like, what do you think of like what Haralabob is saying? And obviously from a point of view of someone that works for mainstream media now, and I, of course, I did at 1.2, and Rufus did also. It's obviously a challenging place to be, but what do you feel about what that part of the Haralabob claim, and whether advantage players should be cautioning other people about the problem gambling aspect of things.
Yeah, so I don't have any existing relationship with Rael Bob at all. I spent many hours on forums trying to read and understand exactly what his angles were in the NBA and, you know, what kind of lessons to learn from that for betting the NBA. And so I have enormous amount of respect for, you know, what he did as an originator, probably still doing to some degree. All of that, like, he's probably coming from the right place, but boy, the tone just fell super flat via Twitter, I thought.
Interesting.
It wasn't like reading it and like kind of cringing, but it was kind of in that ballpark of just, you know, this doesn't, like, there may be an important message here, but I don't know that he's the right messenger necessarily. And, you know, the fact that he was able to, you know, build the bankroll to the point he has in his career, largely through some of the very broken mechanisms of the way that, you know, the space has kind of been over the last 10 years. And then to turn around and be like, you know, hey, by the way, everything's broken. And we're like, yeah, well, you know, I think a lot of us who are playing kind of recognize that. And I think a lot of what's happening this week is really illustrative, you know, to some of the kind of realities we're going to have to deal with the problem gambling. I mean, pretty clearly the Ohtani story has layers and wrinkles and, you know, fascinating kind of implications for, you know, what it means to be a problem gambler and have access to money like that. I mean, you remember in the offseason, the Jags guy who was, you know, a VIP whale at FanDuel, like, stole $20 million from the Jags. And it's like, you know, that the, there's pretty clearly, there's an element of the way that, you know, the true whales who are, you know, losing at a clip of millions of dollars a year, like, the way that they're, you know, kind of, no one, that's cloak and dagger stuff at the likes of the FanDuels and the DraftKings, even in the legal space. And, you know, that's maybe the big shift, right? Like, those players were losing this money in the, I mean, before, through, you know, black market, illegal bookmaking means, you know, much like whatever Ohtani and his interpreter got caught up with. And now it's like kind of under the guise of legality through, you know, the, you know, legal operations onshore. And it doesn't really feel like much has changed, because you could still have these situations where, you know, somebody's embezzling $20 million to fund their habit. And nobody at FanDuel thinks twice about where's this money coming from? Right. No KYC. No, even attempt to try to make sure that this wasn't, you know, coming from a place of, you know, the wrong, one of your most important partners, an NFL franchise. So, you know, I think ultimately, you know, the Rael Bob's kind of tone and a lot of what he was saying, I thought, was sort of directed more at the recreational players who may or may not ever get to the point where they're, you know, anything other than just consistent losers. But I think the real scrutiny needs to kind of come on in terms of how, you know, at what percent of the profits for these profitable endeavors are, you know, assuming they get there or already there, what percent is coming from these, you know, VIP accounts, and where's, you know, how closely is that being monitored? You know, is that sort of like the third rail that nobody really, really wants to, you know, dive into? And, you know, I've kind of assumed that the way that they're doing business, keeping, you know, advantage play to a bare minimum, if at all possible, in their houses, but also kind of identify players that they think they can take advantage of, like, that's not especially ethical. And, you know, that's not, doesn't serve anyone's outcome who wants to be a long-term, you know, player and winner in the space. So, yeah, I think, you know, there's definitely kind of a reckoning coming. And all these stories, I think, are pretty related. And, you know, I think any kind of prediction about what the kind of state of players and, you know, churn and people who just kind of give up because they're tired of losing, like, all of that's going to come to a head in the next 5 years. And, you know, it's kind of tough to predict exactly what the ramifications are going to be. But, you know, we live in California where you can't even have a FanDuel account. So what do we care?
Well, so you mentioned, like, the Rael Bob thing being about recreational bettors, but there's a fine line or a slippery slope between recreational bettor and problem bettor, you know, sure, like, ultimately. And it's you kind of nailed it with this idea of, like, the access to cash kind of situation. You know, obviously one of the things that the unregulated market has is they play on credit, right, in the unregulated market. And I, you know, back in the day when I wrote for ESPN, I wrote a piece about what would happen and the, you know, like my predictions on what would happen when legalization happened. And I thought like the credit piece would be like one of the kind of better pieces, meaning like if you didn't allow people to bet on credit, it would just, it didn't create like that same terrible, you know, behavior potentially. Although like it's interesting. So back to the Ohtani piece too, it sounds like you don't care necessarily about who was losing the money. You're just saying like either of them has access to that money and somehow that's, I mean, like this is a story that makes no sense at all.
Oh yeah.
When you hear about it, right.
It's like
the Occam's razor answer to this is a pretty clear answer, I think. Right.
Yeah. And there is an explanation that a lot of the backtracking and a lot of the, you know, kind of very difficult to parse factual account, I have to put it politely, like the bullshit they're spinning. A lot of that is probably maybe trying to protect Ohtani from whatever like legality comes from having made some of these transfers, whether he was responsible for the betting activity or not, we'll never know probably. But, you know, I think there's a ton of facts that don't add up in any of that story. But at the bottom line, and also like, you know, I'm sure, you know, you've heard and you've seen stories and you've maybe even had, you know, times when you had access to accounts and, you know, you were like, wait, the limits are what? And then you look at the login and the password and you're like, oh, whose account really is this? Right. And like, there's certainly, you know, not, there shouldn't be, you know, kind of broad surprise in my opinion that, hey, there's a professional athlete with ungodly amounts of millions of dollars and nothing to spend it on. And oh, by the way, they happen to be gambling to the tune of negative $5 million net, right? Like that shouldn't really surprise anyone, I don't think. It's probably at the extreme end, right? But I would be, well, you know,
when you mean by that doesn't surprise anyone, you mean that shouldn't surprise the professional bettor who's looked into paperheads or knows that world.
Or even just really followed closely the Michael Jordan stories and the Phil Mickelson stories.
True. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And I think this is just, it's one of those stories that makes so little sense when you read it. And it's just, it's almost like, if you guys were going to lie, couldn't you have come up with something better? Like, this is just like it's a weird thing. All right. So let's move on to, did you see the Reese Davis thing? Like, we're just going through all the mainstream media stuff. The Reese Davis one.
Put squarely in mouth there. Yeah. That was embarrassing.
Well, you know, the thing is, this is now, speaking from very much experience as someone that spent, you know, 2 years on ESPN dealing with ESPN personalities in those days, right? So this is in mid 2015, 16, something like that. These sports center anchors know nothing about sports betting. They know nothing about betting, and they know not like, and sadly, I think that he was, you know, there was no harm in what he was saying. Like, he was just trying to, you know, be witty and have like a nice back and forth. And a lot of times they don't even know, like I used to do all these hits with, you know, Hannah Storm and all these kind of people. And like, they don't know me from Adam. Right. And they're just like trying to provide some sort of witty back and forth. And I, you know, I don't defend what he said, obviously, because it is reckless what he said. And it's very problematic what he said, but I would defend the fact that I think it was out of negligence, not out of, you know, he was not trying to cause any harm. I would say he wasn't trying to really market. He was really just trying to, like, you know, have a witty back and forth with that woman, whoever she was, the personality. Yeah. So
Aaron Katie Dolan, she's a rising star over there by all accounts. And you're right. I know. I agree with you. I think it was poorly chosen, but like, he was trying to make a joke that like gambling Twitter had been like, oh, this sounds like a 100-unit nuclear bomb or whatever. You know, like that was kind of what he was saying, which is like, you made a great case. I'm going to, you know, like I'm really going to think about this. And But yeah, it came across completely.
Although she did say in her piece, like, well, normally I like to have data behind what I say, but in this case, I'm just going to go with this. And it's like
full narrative. Yes.
Although like I'm such a sheep. I did look to see whether it won or lost before I had a real criticism.
I missed entirely.
It was the Northwestern team under.
Oh yeah. That didn't get there
against UConn.
Yeah, I don't think
against UConn, it did. I think it did. I think it was under. So.
Yeah, no, I meant like, yeah, they didn't make that team total or even close, I don't think.
Yeah.
All right. Interesting. Well, just kind of one real quick thought. You're 100%, my experience, at least with people at, you know, kind of high levels across all, you know, the media platform, media spaces, not only just kind of negligence and just not like negligence, but like, you know, searching for the right word, but just kind of like complete know nothing and not really interested in trying to figure it out. Like, it's frustrating if you're a player, these are conveying important information to you. And if you like betting, like, you know, it would be nice if they at least kind of understood at least the basics. And, you know, I will probably get there, I might guess, but there's a huge, huge kind of hesitance in my experience of people who just, they don't really want to be wrong. And if you're doing this for long enough, you know, you're going to be wrong half the time and you just kind of are living with that. And, you know, the idea of being wrong 10% of the time for a lot of the people who come from more of a classical journalism and television background is just unacceptable. And so I don't think they'll ever cross over and really embrace or understand or be able to communicate clearly about gambling. And so it's always going to be a little bit of a niche thing until one of us like really breaks through. And, well, you know, that may never happen.
So I will, I'll challenge your notion that they will get there, because I don't know if they will get there anytime in the near future for exactly the reasons you're saying, right? And ultimately, what I mean by that is there's a refusal by the mainstream media to hire the types of people that they need to hire to actually like go after this the right way. And, you know, I'm obviously biased because, you know, I've been in this world. I'm not in this world right now, meaning I'm not in mainstream media. And there's probably a reason for that because, well, one, I was shitty on TV, but besides that, I am not someone that is willing to like play by the, you know, like I'll say what's on my mind. And, you know, I think there's truth to what Haralabob said, meaning like a lot of these advertisements being in our face and whatnot. Like I was like listening to a podcast on The Ringer the other day, and they're like talking about the parlay builder as part of the advertising content. And I'm just like, this is really, and I don't think we've ever taken an ad dollar from a sports book. You know, recently we've taken it from Splash Sports, which is, I think, more on the recreational side of sports betting, more on the side of like, hey, you know, we did their March Madness Survivor Pool last week, and we promoted it quite a bit. And I have to say, I enjoyed the experience, even though I literally did not get out of the first weekend with my Survivor. Like, I lost. I had three entries by the end, and all three lost before I got out of it. But I you know, it was $100 sweat, and I was literally sweating those games. I cared. And that's kind of like the key sometimes to a lot of this is like, if you really get a fun sweat out of it and don't lose a lot of money, meaning you lose $100 and you found a lot of, to me, that's the key to a good product kind of thing.
Yeah, I agree. And the Survivor stuff and that kind of, you know, particularly for, you know, we've done Calcuttas before where the sweat was 50 times that, but it didn't matter. Like, it's still fun. Survivor in general, like, man, I was in the same boat as you. I had three entries. They were all done by Friday night. That was fun while it lasted, but, you know, especially weird in a year where so much chalk came through.
Yeah, to be that's honest, true. How's that possible?
Yeah. How's that possible? But, just kind of closing thought, the idea, like I personally think anyone who's kind of out there promoting stuff like the parlay builder or like the lotto ticket type of stuff, like the churn on the customer side of it and having fun, like that burns out quick, right? How many times can you lose before you're just like, all right, well, this is not fun anymore for me? You know, like there's reasons that, you know, people gravitate away from certain markets that are, you know, that losing just is more common. You know, And I think ultimately, if you're promoting a product that is going to churn through your customer base, then it's not going to last very long. And, you know, I don't know. But we, you know, the best bet, at least from a media side of it, is like, you know, hey, be transparent about like, hey, I'm playing this, like I'm in it too. Like, this is not just talking head bullshit. This is like, I'm feeling the pain of this loss with you, as opposed to just, you know, hey, we're just going to build a nonsense parlay. And because we think that's hot right now. And, you know, in a year that, you know, that all may change.
All right. We're going to welcome in Jordan Majewski now to talk a little Sweet 16, talk like, oh, this was a very challenging negative part of sports betting. At least now we can talk a little fun March Madness hoops. So we now welcome in Jordan Majewski to the Bet the Process podcast. It's rare that we have someone on that actually knows players' names and knows something about the actual sport itself and can provide commentary other than, well, my model says it should be minus 2.5. So I think, anyways, now that you're here, it's great to have you. And what's your handle if anyone wants to follow you?
Or Cubs Dan. So Jor, J-O-R, and I'm a big Cubs fan. And I made this in like, you know, 20 years ago or however long the app has been around. So J-O-R-C-U-B-S-D-A-N.
Did you do it back when it was called Twitter?
Yeah, of course.
All right, we're going to jump into the games. We're going to go right through all the Sweet 16 games and get your thoughts on all of them. Starting in the East Regional, Iowa State, it's now down to 1.5 over Illinois with a total of 46. What do you think about that game?
Yeah, I think that's the most fascinating game on Thursday. Unfortunately, I've complained about this. I don't know why the games on the West Coast are starting before the games on the East Coast. But anyway, yeah. So, you know, Iowa State plays a aggressive no middle defense. And that means they're going to be trapping the ball screens. They're going to be trapping the post. And Illinois is the kind of team that can play five out. And that has really given Iowa State trouble. Like if you want to see the BYU game, Illinois can play that way where they have, you know, the ability to, like, you know, if they're going to trap Damascus' booty ball, as they like to call it. He's an elite passer. He's been passing the ball, spraying the ball all over the court this tournament. And someone's going to have a horrible matchup against TJ Shannon in isolation. And, you know, if Illinois is hitting those weak side jump shots and finding those, because they're going to find those weak side jump shots, they're going to win this game. You know, Iowa State's offense is the worst left in the tournament, and they, you know, they're polar opposites here. Illinois can score at will, has trouble defending. Iowa State, best defense, can't score. So, you know, that's kind of the game right there. And Illinois is uniquely set up personnel-wise to be able to beat that no middle.
The Illinois getting here was a little bit of a bugaboo for me because I had these guys circled as like a, you know, not to be trusted. And, you know, one of the reasons why, and, you know, this has been kind of tried and true over the last about 5 years, but completely thrown in my face this year, is if you can't create defensive turnovers, you tend to struggle if you are at a deficit. You just need those extra possessions in a one and done type of format. And Illinois, 360th. In tempo-adjusted turnover defense rate, whereas Iowa State is number two. Is there a potentially a live betting angle here to come at Iowa State if Illinois is out there shooting hot in the first half, you know, halftime shot coming through for Iowa State to close that gap just by creating more possessions, in your opinion?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, yeah, you hit the nail on the head in terms of just shot volume overall. You know, the more shots you can get up, more possessions you have, like, that's obviously a good thing. And so Illinois is kind of weird because they've kind of discovered a way to play defense. And so if Iowa State is forcing Underwood's hand to go to danger and change the way they can play five out, then all of a sudden Iowa State's, like you said, going to be back in the game because now they've, you know, taken away the secret sauce in terms of beating them by forcing danger to come on the floor instead of Hawkins or Garrier.
And maybe vice versa, Iowa State can keep Illinois at arm's length if they have a decent lead on them in this game, just because Illinois can't really create extra possessions.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And Iowa State's not going to let you score in transition either. which is a huge factor for Illinois' offense.
Okay, so I'm going to blind bet Iowa State second half. Sounds good.
All right, let's move on to Connecticut. So Connecticut is an 11-point favorite over San Diego State, obviously a rematch of last year's national championship game with a total of 135.5. Does San Diego State have a chance?
The more I look at this, think it plays out almost exactly like the national championship game last year. San Diego State can compete defensively because they are capable of switching all of the UConn elite half court motion stuff they do. But the problem with UConn is then they just turn to the pick and roll offense and they're just as good as that. It's not their preferred way to operate, but they can do it when they have to, and they're just unstoppable when they do it. So to score, though, is going to be the issue for San Diego State, because UConn's kind of, if they have a weakness defensively, it's at the 3 and the 4. San Diego State can't really exploit that. And they run everything through Ladee, and you're not going to post up Klingon. I think Klingon has allowed 9 total points in post defense like the entire year. And, you know, that's kind of a small sample because people don't even try to post him. So Ladee's going to have to be able to play in the mid post, turn and face him, and make Klingon move his feet. And I just don't know if that's a sustainable path or an efficient path to offense for San Diego State. So the defense, I think, can compete at, you know, some level because they can switch off the ball effectively. They just can't expose any minor weakness in the UConn defense.
Yeah, I had to Google it because I obviously remember that UConn won last year, but I didn't remember how bad of a throttling that was.
Yeah, it was a boring game.
Yeah,
you know,
it was just totally tuned out. Yeah, it's like time to prep for the Masters, right?
It was never like a total blowout. It was kind of like, oh, maybe if San Diego State gets a few stops here, you know, like 3 stops, couple buckets, are back in this, and it just never happened. And yeah. I kind of just think that's the way it's going to go tomorrow night.
Looking at paces, looking at projections here, I'm kind of surprised this isn't the lowest total on the board. That belongs to the Duke Houston matchup, which is just a hair under 135 at 134. I guess just in a matchup like this, like UConn has slowed their pace down considerably from last year. You know, is this open up a decent opportunity to expect this to come in well under? A line of 11 would tell you that we're probably not even living in a world where there's going to be a bunch of trips to the free throw line at the end of this one if it plays out as expected, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, if I under would be certainly my knee-jerk reaction, just because San Diego State does have the personnel to defend them, but they don't have the personnel to score. So
you remember what last year's title game total was?
I do not.
Curiosity. It was 131. So we've come a full year. UConn's playing slower, and our total is 4 points higher.
Yeah. That
is
interesting.
Yeah. I think under would be the look there. But this is just, I guess, for full transparency, I got my teeth kicked in on Thursday and Friday, and I just walked away Saturday, Sunday. So college basketball is not treating me especially well right now. So I guess take this all with a grain of salt. Looking kind of into the future some more, Iowa State or Illinois give you any kind of hesitancy to just put UConn and Penn in the Final Four?
Illinois, I think, could give them a better game just because of the way they would force Klingon to defend outside of his comfort zone. And Illinois is a masterful drop defense offense. So UConn would definitely have to change some things up defensively in terms of how they would cover Illinois.
I like it. Moving on to a game that I'm very interested in, North Carolina, 4-point favorite over Alabama, total of 173.5. Does North Carolina get to 100 in this game themselves?
Yeah, it's possible. I don't know. Did you guys watch the entirety of that Alabama Grand Canyon game?
It was like watching an AAU game.
That was about the wildest thing I've seen in the tournament in a while. So, you know, it's kind of...
Florida Colorado gave it a run for its money.
Yeah, it's a bit of a relief, I think, for Alabama to see a little more structure. Like every Grand Canyon trip, down the floor, it was 4 guys on one side of the court. And then just an ISO clear out, you know, every single time. So, you know, in that regard, it's kind of refreshing, I think, for Alabama to see something that isn't so like a little bit unknown to them. But yeah, so the problem for Alabama is they can't defend in ball screens, they can't defend dribble penetration, and they can't defend at the rim. That's kind of a unholy trio there. So, you know, and North Carolina is fully capable of exploiting all of that with Baycott, Davis, you know, you name it. The only thing that would maybe slow North Carolina's offense down is if their Hubert's hand is forced into playing Trimble a lot more minutes in terms of keeping Mark Sears out of the paint and kind of keeping him off his left side where he's just so dominant. And, you know, Trimble's a great defender, not so much a great scorer. So, you know, and then North Carolina is an excellent transition defense as well, and an excellent rim and three defense, which kind of takes away Alabama's two key components there. So, yeah, I think North Carolina should be able to score at will and also defend Alabama reasonably well.
I mean, isn't this come down to Alabama just whether they hit threes? Because the only chance they have is if they're unconscious from three, because they're going to put up a lot, right?
Yeah, basically.
It's a high level of variance.
I guess.
So, yeah, and to do that, they're going to have to. So in that Grand Canyon game, Oates was able to play his more athletic bigs and defensive bigs like Diabate and Pringle. But to keep up with North Carolina, he's not going to be able to do that. If he really wants to score, you know, that means more Grant Nelson again back in there, and he can't defend anybody. So
did you feel like in the first weekend that 3-point rate was up in general relative to what you usually see? This got around pretty good before the tournament, which was like, hey, look at sort of the secret of how these guys upset and these guys upset as mid-majors. It was like, hey, they just got up more threes than they usually do, and it caught people by surprise, and they embraced variance. Like, did any of that echo as you were watching the games last weekend?
You know, not to the point where it was like jumping off the screen to me, like, this is way more than I expected or anything like that.
Even Oakland taking out Kentucky? Oakland, that's just kind of their DNA?
Yeah, you know, Oakland's kind of a weird team, and I kind of noted that before the tournament, that Oakland doesn't play on offense or defense a way a lot of high majors see. You know, they're all ISO with Townsend on the block or having him face up in ISO, and then everybody else, Lampman and Golkey, are just running off a billion cross screens, pin downs, and all this. Yeah. So you kind of got all your focus on that, and then meanwhile, Townsend's left in isolation. So, you know, it's one of two options with them, Townsend in isolation or a three off those screens.
Gotcha. Okay. So one final thought on the UNC game. And I'm not saying this because I'm a UNC hater, which I am. The fact that they also don't create decent defensive turnovers, and they're not in any way elite offensive rebounding. If Alabama is hitting their threes in the first half of this one, any cause for concern? Are you looking for UNC in comeback mode in the second half, or is possession just going to be too great to overcome if they're down by, say, like 7 points?
I think that Alabama's defense is porous enough that it kind of mitigates UNC's inability to create extra possessions in that way. And UNC is one of the lower shot volume teams, higher seeds. Like, they're at the bottom with Creighton, and Kansas was down there too, and we saw what happened to Kansas. So, you know, it's definitely a factor, but Alabama kind of, with the way they can't defend, is like, it could just be efficiency every time down the court where it kind of mitigates the inability of North Carolina to create extra possessions.
All right, let's move on to Arizona. 7-point favorite over Clemson, 151.5. You know, we've had this like elite top four all season, and now it's like, is Arizona breaking into that? And like, they're maybe ready to challenge that top four can Clemson give them a game here?
Yeah. So it's a pretty interesting game because Clemson's bigs are going to make Ballo defend in areas he's uncomfortable in, but Clemson also can't defend in pick and roll. And if Tommy Lloyd really wants to embrace Bradley over Boswell, they're going to torch Clemson's pick and roll defense. Now, the same thing could have been said about New Mexico Same thing could have been said about Baylor, two elite pick and roll offenses. And then they went like 9 for 47 from three, and it didn't matter how good they were in pick and roll. They couldn't hit a jump shot. And Clemson will sell out completely in terms of underscreening. Both of these teams actually allow just meager rim rates defensively. So, you know, there is a lot of jump shooting variance potentially in this game. But I think Arizona has the personnel, if Lloyd is really going after Bradley instead of Boswell and embracing what he brings offensively, to kind of, you know, scramble Clemson's pick and roll defense overall.
Anything you've seen in the tournament so far change your perspective on the ACC to the good and Pac-12 to the bad? Or, you know, is Arizona kind of, are they are who we thought they were?
You know, it's, I see a lot of debate on Twitter about, you know, conference strength and who was undervalued, who got, you know, screwed by the committee and all that. I never really think of it that way in terms of like, you know, the ACC, you know, is doing better, the better than everyone expected them to, or, you know, the Mountain West is a little different because of the altitude thing. But, you know, I kind of don't really pay attention to the, you know, ACC is overperforming in the tournament. See, we should have, like, who should have got in over them, you know, otherwise, like, it doesn't, not something I really take up my brain space with.
So then the key question is Arizona versus Clemson pre-tournament price, probably a little different than the market has adjusted Clemson up and Arizona maybe down a bit. Do you think that creates any kind of edge for Arizona in this one at what's the number? Six and a half, seven. Yeah, it's gotten, this is getting bet out, I guess. Circa's already 7.5. So this may close, close up there. Yeah.
But yeah, I agree with what you're saying generally, but before it got to 7.5.
All right. We got Purdue -5 over Gonzaga, 154 is the total. That Gonzaga Kansas game I thought was going to be epic. One of the good ones in that first half, and then it all
great
just,
first half, yeah.
Yeah, I actually at the halftime I kind of looked at myself and I'm like, man, Gonzaga plays the most entertaining tournament games. If you think about some of the most entertaining games we've watched over the years, they've been Gonzaga games.
Sure.
But then they just pulled away. Do they have a chance to upset Purdue?
Yeah, that Kansas game, it was watching Dickinson play pick and roll defense. It's one of those situations where you feel bad, like you feel embarrassed as a, you know, third party observer. Like, you know, it was hard to watch. But anyway, you know, this is a rare game where we've had an in-season sample to look at. And both teams are kind of playing differently from that, because that was way back in, you know, November and Hawaii and neutral floor and all that. So it's kind of hard to take too much from that. But in that game, I think Gonzaga, I think few doubled Edie just twice. And he always pretty much islands EK. Because EK is a great post defender. So that's kind of interesting, because they don't throw every body at Edie, which I think is kind of a good thing. You know, like, it doesn't matter if you throw three people at him, whatever, he's going to get a foul most likely. And it's not going to help you. So if you just kind of island a guy on him and a great defender like EK, you kind of take your chances and hope they miss shots. And Purdue did miss shots that game, but Gonzaga missed way more shots. It was actually both teams' like worst 3-point shooting game of the year. But, you know, Gonzaga, their pick and rolls are great. We saw what they did to Kansas. They started out with Dickinson and drop, got torched, started hedging with him. He got torched. So Purdue hedges with their fours more, because they have this like cadre of kind of athletic fours who can do that. And they've also started playing a little more no middle lately, which is pretty interesting against Gonzaga. So they kind of soft double with the four man post. So they're going to do that to EK. But I think a lot, if Few is going to island EK, a lot's going to come down to fouls early. Because if EK picks up anyone on Gonzaga picks up any, they have zero depth. And that's, you know, going to probably be their doom if Edie's getting his typical foul calls.
It's almost like one of those situations where you just kind of like let Edie get his and hope that he just misses enough shots that it's, you know, you're not giving up threes instead.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's yeah, exactly what I was saying, that Edie's going to get his single coverage, double coverage, whatever you want to do. You got to basically hope that, you know, ancillary guys aren't going off on you. But Gonzaga does have a chance offensively with the way they pick and roll, and could force Edie into some uncomfortable spots. And they shot 32 threes that game by design, really, because they were popping EK out and popping Greg out and trying to force Edie to defend out there. But unfortunately, they hit six out of those 32 threes. So, hit some more of those. It'll be different. And the way they've used Greg in pick and pop lately has been totally different from the way they played them in Hawaii. So something to watch out for.
Is there anything different about this year's Purdue team that people missed coming into this year's tournament, as they, you know, kind of a common, you know, not taking them to the finish line?
Yeah. So I think Painter, he kind of has this undeserved rep as not being a good in-game adjuster or season long adjuster. He's really changed the way they play defense, and Edie is way more versatile defensively than he was last year. Moves his feet better, and I'm not saying like they're going to switch 1 through 5 with him or anything like that, but he's a capable defender outside of drop coverage, which is all he could do last year. So, and you know, the guards have gotten older. That's kind of like the main overarching thing that, you know, Braden, you can't really bully Braden Smith a little bit, although he has had trouble with hard hedging defenses in general. And if you watch the beginning of that Utah State game, their hard hedge was giving them a little bit of problems. And Gonzaga is one of the most known hard hedge defenses in the country. So that'll be interesting to watch. But then, you know, after that initial trouble with Utah State, they went on and laid, you know, 106 on them. So, you know, they make adjustments. They've adjusted the way they operate offensively, the way they operate defensively. So I think it's just been a great job by Painter in terms of developing Edie as more than just a lumbering guy in drop coverage.
All right, let's move on to a game that is moving the opposite direction of how I thought it would go. Tennessee now a 3-point favorite over Creighton with a total of 143.5. It seemed like there was, at least reading some mainstream narratives, like there was some real Creighton momentum after the performance against Oregon. What do you like here? Or what do you see in this game, Jordan?
So Creighton's a tough offense on short prep, but Tennessee's fully capable of switching all their off-ball stuff and all their off-ball screening. The problem I see for Tennessee defensively is their best defenders are Meshack and Triple J, and they're kind of wet blankets offensively. So, you know, you're going to have to trade, and they match up well because Creighton just doesn't, they don't use a traditional point guard per se. You know, they run a lot of offense through Shireman and Alexander, some bigger guys, and that's perfect for Tennessee defensively with Meshack and Triple J, but they're going to, you know, bring the offense down. You know, Tennessee is much better against drop coverage defenses than they are hard hedging bigs. And no one drops more than Creighton. Although Kalkbrenner changed the game a little bit on a few hard hedges and ball screen traps against Oregon late. So that was kind of interesting, but I doubt McDermott does anything crazy in terms of changing up their ball screen coverage on the fly like that. But yeah, Tennessee is well suited to defend what Creighton does, but it's also going to cost them some offense in that regard.
If this sets up for a rematch of Tennessee Purdue, which we saw on a neutral court right after, ironically, Purdue beat Gonzaga, that market, by the way, opened Purdue -3, got bet up to 4. Somebody came in at the close and took all the 4s. It landed 4. Yeah. That kind of market, we'll probably see that deja vu all over again if that's our final in the Midwest.
I would assume so. Yeah, I think Tennessee had like just an obscene amount of fouls in that game, which tends to happen against Purdue. But yeah, I would envision a similar scenario in terms of the movement.
All right, moving on to Marquette -6.5 over the only double digits seed left, NC State. Total 151.5. Is Marquette going to be able to do what they did, you know, with the putting a big in a pick and roll here that's going to cause trouble, or what do you think is going to happen here?
Yeah, the way Marquette just the most inventive pick and roll team left in the tournament, probably the country. But yeah, the way they can invert pick and rolls, you know, using Oso as the ball handler or Oso Cam Jones pick and rolls, Kolek, you know, like once you get Kolek as the roller, like, you know, it's that's a, you know, teams aren't prepared to defend that. And then you're going against DJ Burns, who can't move defensively at all. So that's, you know, something Marquette can easily exploit in the North Carolina State's pick and roll defense. But on the other end, it's how does Marquette defend Burns? You know, he's the ultimate damned if you do, damned if you don't guy. You don't double him. He's got such a dizzying array of post moves and soft touch around the rim. Then you double him and he whips the ball all over the floor. Now, the crazy thing watching North Carolina State is just Duke make this run is so infuriating because they find Keats finally put four shooters around Burns. And you're like, why, you know, why didn't you do this at any point during the year until you decided your job was on, you know, your job was on the line. You decided you had to win games. So, you know, having O'Connell out there playing 30 plus minutes a night has changed their offense. And it's just the spacing's totally different. Burns can just see wherever he wants to throw the ball. They have Diarra now in the corner, who's a great defender and actually hitting those corner threes. You know, it's totally different. And speaking of Diarra, I assume he gets the Oso assignment, which is kind of not bad for North Carolina State. He's a really versatile defender, long guy with athleticism that can move around. So that's an interesting game. I don't see how North Carolina gets stops, and DJ Burns is going to do what DJ Burns does, but ultimately they can't stop Marquette's pick and rolls.
Okay. You talked me into the over there.
Yeah. I talked myself into that as well.
All right. Last game. We got Houston -4 against Duke with a 134.5. Obviously, are the injury concerns for Duke? Are they real? Like Roach, I think, got hurt, and obviously Foster's out, but is there an issue there, or they probably have more talent than Houston, right? I mean, just from a pure.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're a better, they can shoot the hell out of the ball. And so, you know, you can kind of copy paste what we said about Iowa State's defense and apply it to Houston. You're going to see a lot of ball screen traps, the post doubles, all that. But Duke's an elite jump shooting team and an elite catch and shoot team. And if they can handle those traps, especially if Roach is healthy and, you know, get the ball to McCain, they're going to have jump shots to hit all day, as long as they're not turning the ball over. Houston, on the other hand, they have no rim scoring. They score, I think, at the first percentile in rim offense, which is, you know, about as bad as it gets. And Duke has struggled with really athletic teams in the front court that can, you know, really bully them inside. And, you know, Flip is going to play a big role here too with his short roll creation, that kind of those short roll creations against those no middles or aggressive ball screen trapping defenses like Iowa State. And we saw Kansas really hurt Houston with the short roll between the high low action there between Dickinson and KJ Adams. So Duke can absolutely do that. I think they have all of the keys offensively to beat this Houston defense, and I think Houston is totally reliant on tough jump shots going in and tough jump shot creation. So I like Duke.
I'd like to hear that. Duke in a Calcutta, so that's good to hear. Okay, last question for you. You know, all the stuff that you talk about is based on your astute observations, watching tendencies, etc. Which coach, and we had Ken Palm on last week, and you know, we talked about one of the strengths of UConn being like their versatility. And we were talking about just this concept of versatile teams doing well in March. Which of the teams remaining has the biggest chance outside of UConn to surprise and be versatile? Like, you know, you could say like, oh, is an Alabama going to like play more D or something like that? Which is the one you think will surprise us of the last 16 teams left? I guess now we're only talking about 15 because no UConn.
So first of all, I think last year I came on the week after Pomeroy So I like to think of Pomeroy's like my lead in.
He's your warm up act.
Yeah, my warm up guy.
There you go.
So yeah, that's pretty incredible that you know, a guy who should be in the Basketball Hall of Fame really is warming up for me. But anyway, so I think I don't know if Illinois counts as an answer, but I think they are the team that has the most. Underwood is willing to change styles on both ends, and they have the personnel like packages kind of like I mentioned with Danger. They can come like he totally changed. They were kind of getting smoked by Moorhead's motion offense in that first game in the first half. Then Danger came in. He just rode them all the way and they dominated from there on out because he changes the way they play defense. And, you know, it's not like he's a total loss offensively. It does change the way they play five out, of course, but he's really efficient around the rim. And so I think Illinois' ability to change the way they play completely on both ends is like, you know, call it the X factor or whatever. And Underwood's willingness to embrace that as well, instead of just going down with the ship, like you would see, I don't know, Tom Izzo do, for instance.
Sounds like you're ready to make a bet on Illinois against UConn, but maybe not to win outright. Am I reading correctly?
Yeah, I mean, I would be on that boat. Yeah.
Okay. You got a just in general, I just out of curiosity, UConn versus Purdue, is that like a 3.5 point spread, or like what's the smallest spread you could envision in a title game if UConn's there?
I think that's about what I'd say. Yeah, 3.
Wow. Jesus. I forgot to ask you about UNC Arizona. Pick them.
Yeah, I think Arizona would ultimately take money.
Okay. Duke favored over Marquette?
Yeah.
Houston significantly favored over Marquette? Maybe.
I don't know. Yeah, probably. Okay. Significantly is, yeah, maybe pushing it, but yeah.
4.5, 5, something like that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay. That's...
And then Purdue, Houston? Purdue favored?
Yeah, Purdue probably.
Wow. Man.
Slightly.
All right. I like it. We got all the combinations covered. Jordan, thank you for joining us. Thank you for being the main act to Ken Pomeroy's opening act.
Absolutely.
We'll talk to you next season, but good luck. Good luck this weekend.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on again.
So that was our interview with Jordan Majewski, which great tier X's and O's. I think my main takeaway there, I like the Duke thing, and Duke it seems like is taking a little bit of money right now.
Yeah.
I think the Bama thing is interesting because they're only a 4-point underdog, and you listen to all the mainstream media and it basically, you would think that they basically have no shot, that they're, you know, UNC is going to put up 100 and Alabama is going to score, you know, 70 or something, 80 or something like that, but they're definitely not going to get to 100. So it's just interesting that the line's only 4, if that's the case. Always makes me think like there's some smart people that probably think Bama's got a chance. How about you? Any takeaways?
Yeah, I mean, I generally agree with all that. You know, it's been a chalky tournament so far, and you know, the fact that you have this many, you know, narrow spreads on Sweet 16 weekend feels a little like an outlier, which is cool. So these games should be really, really high, you know, really, really high quality, and I think most of the best bets are probably going to be in game or halftime bets, depending on, you know, what you're seeing specifically play out with some of these teams and their approaches, and then how they're meant, you know, how they can deal with that. Like my favorite angle is literally just going to be hoping that Iowa State is either, you know, meaningfully ahead or meaningfully behind Illinois at halftime and come in on Iowa State with the idea that they're either going to keep Illinois at arm's length because they don't turn over the ball and Illinois can't create turnovers, or, you know, that they can come back by doing, you know, creating extra possessions. But, yeah, it's kind of sobering to hear Jordan's thoughts on price for Connecticut games. And I got to kind of look at their outright again and see if it maps out, because if they're going to be, you know, if they're going to close no worse than -3.5 against anybody in the final. Yeah, this starts to make their outright price look pretty interesting with who's left.
I might have taken a little UConn +2 something last night.
So,
yeah, that was the best. It seemed like a good price, so. All right, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Drew, thank you for filling the big shoes of Rufus Peabody. We're looking for- And we'll talk to you guys all again next week.
All the numbers in a simulated system that break down the data, analytically driven. Media coverage of sports gambling is pathetic. The bottom line is watered down. It seems like they don't get it. Puppeteers are but the engines running off unleaded. None of it's organic. It all sounds synthetic. That's why I fucks with Jeff Ma and his dog Rufus. No locks of the year. They just tell you what their truth is. Maybe make your pockets fatter as the bookies get thinner. Give the information, turn the losing bettors into winners. Yeah. Sturm Herm, reppin' Rutgers, Jeff Ma, Rufus Peabody, crunching all the numbers, Massey Peabody rankings, we're looking for the edge, analytically driven, crunching all the numbers.